Welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Today we are very excited to bring you Gail Slater. Gail is the Senior Vice President of Strategy and Policy at Fox. We are very excited to have Gail on. We started communicating with Gail pre-pandemic, going back and forth, and this is very often the case, but we are very excited to have her here, and it was worth the wait. So, Gail, good morning.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me. Many Zoom calls later, we're finally together. So thanks.
Yes, we are finally here.
We did it.
And here we are. So, Gail, I don't really know where to begin. So I think what I'll do is start with your current job and go backwards. You've had some incredible jobs in Washington, the Internet Association, and at the White House. But let's start with your current work, what you currently do and your responsibilities and what that is like.
Sure. So as I always say, and you can tell from the accent, I'm not from these parts originally, only in America. Because I have been very fortunate. I've had some great opportunities in life.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Dublin, Ireland.
Oh, Welcome.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Yeah, so you're O'Brien, and I'm originally a Conlon.
Oh.
Yes. Yeah, so we have that connection in common.
We do indeed. So we are County Clare. What county are you from?
Dublin.
Okay, of course. All
right. The county.
Right, of course, of course.
The Dubliners are like the New Yorkers of Ireland.
So. Are they? Okay.
Anyways.
So you grew up in Dublin.
I did, yes. Yeah, but you wanted to sort of go backwards in time.
Well, wait, let's start with Dublin.
Start with Dublin. All right.
We can spend the whole podcast on Dublin. So what was it like growing up in Dublin?
It was, in the 80s, very, very different country from it is, you know, what it is today.
Yes.
Today, it's like a hub of globalization. You've got the pharma industry there. You've got big chunks of the tech industry there. Very outward-looking country. When I was growing up, it was more inward-looking, more parochial, I guess. And you also had, throughout the 80s and into the 90s, you had the troubles in the north of Ireland. And so that was a big feature of day-to-day life, even in the south, where we weren't directly impacted, but it was a part of it. So that's sort of the political side of it. But other than that, look, it's a great, great country still. Good place to grow up. Lots of fresh air, lots of green grass, good education system. And
when you say the troubles in the north impacted you in Dublin, obviously, are you talking more about in the news and everything going on?
Yes. And domestic politics down south too. There was a civil war that was fought in the 1920s that still reverberated north and south up till the 90s. It's lessened now in large part to great work done by a bunch of Americans in aiding the Good Friday Peace Agreement in the 90s.
Yeah. Senator George Mitchell on behalf of President Clinton.
Really incredible. And a lot of Americans since then, Republican and Democrat, have been really supportive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's incredible how peaceful it's been.
Yes. And that's led to stability, which then led to a lot of the economic growth, globalization, inward investment. That's more of a feature of the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. In Ireland, yeah.
All right, and before we get back to Fox, where did you go to law school?
In Dublin.
Oh, okay.
In Dublin, yeah. So the way it's done over there is you do undergrad law, which is a big choice to make as a 17-year-old. You know, hey, I think I'm going to be a lawyer. But that's the way the system works over there. And I went to England after I graduated in Dublin. I went to England. I trained as a lawyer in the City of London, with a firm that was a global law firm. And so they sent me initially to Brussels. I did antitrust law. That's a big part of the legal scene in Brussels through the EU institutions. And then they sent me to DC. So that's what brought me here. They had an office here in DC and I came to DC to work there.
Okay. And what was your, I might as well just continue on this on this thread. So what was your first, so you were doing that and then what was your next job in DC?
It was to go work at the Federal Trade Commission, which for those of you who don't know, it is at the federal level, it's the leading consumer protection agency. So they do privacy, They do fraud, general consumer protection, as well as antitrust. And so I was an antitrust lawyer. I went to go work in the antitrust part of the Federal Trade Commission. Did a lot of like merger reviews, investigations, litigation. I did that for about 7 years. So I was like a trial attorney for about 7 years. And then I went to go work for one of the commissioners my last 3 years at the FTC. So 10 years altogether.
Wow. Which commissioner did you work for?
A woman named Julie Brill, who is now with Microsoft. And she's sort of one of the leading, she was on the commission, the leading privacy advocate. Big part of the consumer protection mission at the FTC is privacy. Mm-hmm. And then she went to go work at Microsoft. And she's doing a lot of the same work over at Microsoft.
And what was it like going from your staff job to working directly for a commissioner? What was that like?
It was fascinating. Some days you felt like you weren't working at the same organization because the job was so different. I mean, a line attorney, you're working on one case at a time, one set of facts at a time. If it's a merger, two companies, and it's very fact dependent, you're using very different skill set. You're doing investigations, you're taking depositions, reviewing documents, very sort of hands-on, nuts and bolts lawyering. And then to go work for a commissioner, it's a different role. You're advising on the work that you used to do, as it were. So the staff at the FTC put the cases together, they make their recommendation to the commission. It goes up to the commission for a vote. And the job of an advisor to a commissioner is to review the work and ask questions of the staff, of the bureau directors and so on, and then make a recommendation to the commissioner, because at the end of the day, the FTC is a 5-member commission and they vote things up or down, whether it's an enforcement action or a policy report, whatever is coming through the commission. They're the central clearinghouse. And so the work is very varied. At the commission level, you're looking at everything. You're like the sort of central clearinghouse for all of the work coming in from different parts of the commission. And it was very challenging, very, very rewarding work. And I learned a lot in 3 years.
I bet you did. And that, and 3 years seems to me like it would be a long time to work for a commissioner like that.
Yeah, she was very, very busy, hard charging.
And then so from there, you made the jump to the private sector, to the Internet Association?
That's right. That's right. So that was about 2014. And the Internet Association at that moment in time was a rare enough thing. It was a startup trade association.
Yes.
And there aren't too many of them. It's rare that you see a whole trade association set up from scratch, as it were. And so it was a unique opportunity at that moment in time. You were looking at a lot of sort of new novel issues as they intersected with the internet and the companies that we represented. Big part of it was privacy, because privacy is still a large issue, you know, for internet companies, data security, some intellectual property issues, international trade, you name it. And so it was a real sort of stretch assignment, because it was a startup and because of the variety of the portfolio of issues that we had to deal with day in, day out.
A stretch assignment. I like that.
Yeah.
But you're right. You're exactly right in that you don't see many startup associations and then very quickly become like the association of these tech companies. It's quite incredible. And now it's very much, kind of a go-to association for policy and government relations.
I'm going to give a shout out to our good friend who introduced us, Dusty Brighton, for playing an outsized role in making it so. He, again, was attracted to the Internet Association because it was a stretch assignment for him. And for those of you who don't know Dusty, he's a state lobbyist, consummate pro, good, loyal friend. He was given the task of setting up the sort of state lobbying practice group at the Internet Association and making it more of a 50-state group. And he did that with limited resources and a huge heart. And I thought it did a terrific job. And as I understand it, they're still widely regarded for their state level work at the association.
Oh, yeah. And they're still very active. And with a lot of associations, you know, many, I was going to say most, but many or most of their members already have teams on the ground. And some do not. And the Internet Association lends itself to testify and help in that regard. And you're 100% correct about Dusty. I remember first meeting Dusty, and he is just, and he's been a guest on the podcast, as you mentioned. I'd encourage people to go back and listen to it. And Dusty is just the salt of the earth, would give you the shirt off his back, very smart, very hardworking, very practical, and now has kind of is maybe even himself doing some multi-state, because he has contacts across the country. And so Dusty will can kind of almost go into any state. But I think now he's based back down in Arkansas.
Is that correct? That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Where he came from, he and his wife both.
Right. So he does Arkansas, but then he also does other states. And if he doesn't do other states, he has multiple contacts in other states. Yeah. For anyone thinking about getting into state government relations or trying to understand it, Dusty would be a great resource to touch base with.
He is a terrific mentor as well.
Yeah. And so you spent 3 years there or so, and
yes.
You enjoyed it. And then you left and went to, is that when you went to the White House?
That's when I went to the White House, to the National Economic Council.
And what was that like? Not many people that can say that they worked at the White House.
No, no. And again, going back to my opening statement, only in America.
It's
right.
It's very true. Only in America.
I feel like I can't say that often enough because a lot of people are down on America right now. And so I'm here to say, as an immigrant, as someone who came here with a suitcase in 2003, don't give up on America.
Well, Gail, I love that. I think that's
okay.
A great message.
Yeah.
So tell us about your work at the White House.
So the National Economic Council, which is where I went to work, is it's a part of a component, they call them, within the White House that was set up in 93 by then President Clinton, by executive order. And the job of the National Economic Council is to be almost a counterpart to the National Security Council, which nearly everybody's familiar with, and it's been around for a lot longer, but focused more on economic issues and bringing, in White House parlance, economic equities to the table when big decisions are being made that involve like the economy, national security, and so on. So that's the National Economic Council. It's one of a few policy-making councils. That's another thing that I might need to explain. So the policy-making councils within the White House are tasked with harnessing all the talent, ideas, and resources of the federal agencies in implementing the White House's policy priorities. So that, and it's called the interagency process. Okay. So the job of the policymaking council is to identify the priority issues for that White House at that moment in time, form an interagency, which is again, all of the resources, the talent and so on of the agencies across the executive branch and work through an issue and implement an issue as policy. That's often started with, an executive order. That's a term everybody's familiar with. There's a lot of them flying around right now.
both in Washington and at the state level, there's executive orders flying around everywhere. Yeah.
So that's kind of essentially the executive order is saying this is, it's first off, it's saying this is a priority for this administration. Then it's saying, here are the agencies that we think have the expertise, the resources to implement the policy. And then it's identifying what the policy next steps are in order to implement. So that's the kind of thing that if you're at the National Economic Council, the National Security Council, Domestic Policy Council, that's the task for someone who sits on the National Economic Council. The National Economic Council is not very big. We could all fit in one room and we'd sit and have staff meetings with our boss, Larry Kudlow, sitting around one table. So what we're supposed to do is be small but mighty and be a force multiplier. So work with the agencies on implementing the policy. And it's divided by economic sector. So I did tech and telco, cybersecurity. My counterparts did international trade or financial services, you name it.
Okay. And so the president would issue, for example, an executive order on something. Larry Kudlow would come in and meet with the Economic Council. And how many members are on the council?
So it sort of fluctuated. I would say just a dozen of us.
Okay.
And then there's at the principal level, right? So we were the day-to-day staff. Mm-hmm. And then at the principal level on the formal National Economic Council, you have like the Secretary of Commerce, the Treasury Secretary, the big sort of cabinet members who have clear equities in economic issues. Mm-hmm. And so Larry would he would interface with those principles.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then can you give us an example of something you had to work on during your time there?
Sure. So this is, well known. It was under wraps for some time, but you know, one of the stated priorities of the Trump administration, it's no secret, was China. Mm-hmm. And China as it relates to national security and so on and so on. One of the issues identified both by the National Economic Council and the National Security Council early on was the extent to which Chinese telco gear, I won't name any companies, most people know who they are, was populating the US networks, right? So, and mm-hmm. looking to 5G in particular going forward, would there be Chinese equipment in 5G networks? An executive order was worked up. It was signed by the president and it went to the Commerce Department for implementation. That's something that I worked on with the National Security Council. It's still the work that's ongoing. It's still an issue. It's a bipartisan issue, I believe, certainly on the Hill. I think the early signs are from the Biden administration. They intend to carry on the policy. Mm-hmm. And so that's an example of the kind of thing I would have worked on.
Wow, very interesting. And yeah. You're right, it does seem very bipartisan on an issue like that. And so where was your office?
In the old executive office building, so right across from the West Wing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How long did you work there?
I was there, all in all, it was about 18 months.
Okay.
It felt like 5 years, most of those jobs do. And it was about 18 months.
And so what is it like walking in every day to the old executive office building onto the White House campus? It must never get old.
Never gets old. No.
From someone from Dublin, you're walking into the White House, you're thinking, wow, this is a pretty good country.
Yeah, yeah. The other, and this might make you giggle, the other impression that you come away with is just how small that campus actually is. When you consider the amount of power that's concentrated on that campus between the old executive office building and the White House itself. Mm-hmm. You go over to the West Wing of the White House and it's like Toy Town. They have these tiny offices.
Very tiny.
But they're
yes.
making these really big decisions in these tiny offices. So that's another impression that I'd share with you that might not be obvious to some people. And in fact, the joke is that the offices in the old executive office building are way bigger than the West Wing offices. But of course, the West Wing real estate is of much higher value.
Right. It's all about proximity, not the size of your office.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. I remember the first time I saw the White House briefing room, I was like, oh my God, this room is tiny.
Yes.
Because you think it's going to be so big because from the way you see it on the camera angles.
That's right.
And so was it tough to leave or were you exhausted and ready to leave? How did that come about?
It was hard to leave. And it was very bittersweet as far as leaving Larry Kudlow behind, because I just make no secret of it, adore the man. He's just a class act and a good boss.
So can I, sorry to interrupt you, Gail, can I say, did you know Larry before you started working there?
I did not. In fact, so here's the story. Take a step back to the beginning of my tenure. So the story is that I was hired by Gary Cohn, who was then the NEC director. And that was at the beginning of 2018. And to my surprise, was hired because I had a 10-minute interview with Gary. Well, it turns out everybody gets a 10-minute interview with him because as the former COO of Goldman Sachs, he's interviewed literally thousands of people. And so he has a rule of thumb, if he can't make up his mind in 10 minutes, then it's not happening.
Huh.
And so, yeah, so I left thinking, oh, that was nice. I can tell everybody I met Gary Cohn once. And then I got a call the next day. And it was, when can you start? So I started March 2018.
Wow. So your interview was with Gary?
It was with Gary, yeah.
Wow.
So it was with Gary and I started and I was doing a transition with my very dear friend, Grace Coe, who I took over from. Mm-hmm. She had been my predecessor. And midweek that week, Gary resigned. Gary resigned and he came in and he sat around that tiny table I was describing earlier where you could fit the entire staff of the NEC.
He said, yeah. Gail, welcome.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you. Good luck. I'm done.
He said, and then he said, sorry, kid. I'll never forget that.
Oh, <geez. laughs>
but then Larry arrived around the next week and they did their own transition. And I knew straight away, look, this is someone that I think I can get along with. He's got a good heart. And we kind of took it from there. But I thought maybe this would be like the shortest tenured job I'd ever had. Could be just a week, right? So,
because you were hired by his predecessor.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So what is it about Larry that you like so much?
He has a, he won't mind me saying this, I don't think, because he talks about it openly himself. He's an addict. He says he'll be an addict for the rest of his life, but he's been sober for, you know, 20 plus years. Mm-hmm. And with that, I believe, comes a sort of grace and wisdom that mm-hmm. you don't often see in people. He's not an angry person. He's a patient person, forgiving, mm-hmm. very forgiving of himself and others. Mm-hmm. And that shows, he brings that to his work. He's innately curious. You know, he would joke about the fact that here he is, he's a man in his 70s, and he's learning about 5G and spectrum and the cloud and various tech issues for the first mm-hmm. time in his life. But he was very open to that. And mm-hmm. we would just have these wonderful sort of tutorial type sessions where we talk about this technology, what it is, what it means. And I remember the very first time I went over to do something like that. He said to me, he said, well, why does this matter? And I thought, God, I got to come up with something really good here because this is my shot to get his attention. You know, this is a very, very busy man. And he's yep. thinking about the whole of the economy and international trade and God knows what else. And he said, why does this matter? And I said, because it's the future of the economy, Larry. And he said, bingo. And then to his credit, he knew that 5G was a priority, very important, both from a national security standpoint, as well as an economic standpoint. And he took it on as an issue, as one of his priority issues. And we worked together. I handed off to the woman who took over from me. He kept going with it. And he was a champion of 5G deployment, to his credit. And he took it on in his 70s. So I hope I've demonstrated enough that I have a lot of respect and admiration for Larry for doing that.
I think you have. And what is Larry doing now?
So he wrapped up his tenure. And mm-hmm. then just last week, it was announced that he has his own show on the Fox Business Network.
Oh,
so we're colleagues again.
So you're back. You're back together again.
Yeah, yeah. And as you know, he had his own show.
Oh, yeah,
on,
yeah,
for years.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So we were talking about how you decided to leave the White House, which was tough. And so tell us about that and ending up at Fox.
Yeah. So the summer of 2019, Fox had, you know, they were going through a big merger. They were with Disney.
Yep.
Disney acquired the Fox movie studio, which was a big mm-hmm. part of the business. And the merger obviously had ripple effects for the whole company at Fox. Mm-hmm. They were downsizing, they were regrouping, they were becoming what they call the new Fox, different from the old Fox. And mm-hmm. that had an impact on the DC office. And so they had an opening at a senior level, which is a rare enough thing, right? Within a GR shop in DC
yes.
for
yes.
an established company like Fox. And so I went to go talk to my now boss, Danny O'Brien, mm-hmm. about, you know, what the opening was, what it was in the contours. And it seemed like we had a good match in terms of skill and experience. They were looking for someone who was more of a generalist who could jump from issue to issue. So not in a stovepipe sort of siloed situation mm-hmm. and someone who could be a little bit more flexible. And because of the work that I'd done, whether at the NEC, which was a huge portfolio, or before that at the Internet Association, also a big portfolio, I was a good match for what they were looking for.
And so you're based in DC. Is Danny also based in DC?
He is.
And what are your responsibilities today?
Well, as I was saying, it's like, you know, it can vary day to day, which I like. Not everybody likes that. Some people want to be just king of their domain, do, you know, the same thing, be in a stovepipe. So just to give you an idea, so part of what the company's doing, and this is across the industry, old media is digitizing, right? Mm-hmm. And so that means that things are shifting online, streaming, you know, big streaming platforms being launched once a month, it seems like these mm-hmm. days. And so we're part of that transition. I knew a bunch about digital policy. So a resource internally for the folks who work on our digital platforms. Mm-hmm. That's part of it. And then with digitization, obviously comes data privacy issues, data security issues. So from a policy standpoint, it's important to have somebody who can track those things, right?
Yep.
So that's like that's one example. But then another example of, and this maybe shows why it's a more generalist role, is I also do some copyright in my spare time, right? So the movie studio, obviously very content rich environment. Mm-hmm. The movie studio was sold, but we're still making content, right? And we're doing live streaming, like broadcasting and so on. So you need someone to track copyright issues. Much of last year, I worked on legislation along with colleagues from Disney, NBCU, and various trade associations. The legislation had to do with what's called closing the streaming loophole. And so until the end of last year, under the copyright laws, misappropriating a digital stream without permission from the copyright owner and streaming it out was a mere misdemeanor. It was not a felony, different from other forms of distribution of content. Mm-hmm. And so the idea, the goal of the group that we formed last year, working with Senator Tillis's office from North Carolina in the Senate, was to close this streaming loophole. So in other words, update the copyright laws so that illegal streaming was no longer a mere misdemeanor, it became a felony. And there are a lot of bad guys out there who are streaming content illegally at great expense to the original content creators, both large and small. And so it seemed like a worthy goal, good exercise. And mm-hmm. we worked through that process for most of last year. And it got it enacted into law at the end of the year, which was great. Doesn't always happen that way. So that's another example of what I do.
That is great.
Yeah.
And now it would strike me, now is a lot of the illegal streaming, is it here in the US or is it abroad or is it both?
Yeah, it's both. It's both.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it would strike me that a lot of these issues that you work on are not partisan.
They shouldn't be.
Do they become? So sometimes they become,
Yeah, we're living in a very political environment, right?
Yes.
I'm with you. I don't know why copyright should be a partisan issue. Sometimes, towards the end of a process, things get partisan. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, this one didn't, and we did a good enough job explaining and unpacking it that it became just a common sense bipartisan mm-hmm. issue and mm-hmm. from an economic standpoint. So yeah, but we're living in a very political moment, so.
Yeah, most things do become partisan.
At some point, yeah.
But I would imagine that hopefully copyright could be one of those things that,
because
as you know, in DC, even though there's these, brutal partisan fights going on, there's still a lot of work being done under the surface.
Sure.
All the time. Yeah. And how big is your office when you were all in the office in DC? How many people are in your DC office?
So all in all, we're, 7-8 people in the DC office. We also have some folks out in LA because the company is still headquartered in LA on the original movie studio lot.
Okay.
And so we have some folks who work local state issues in California, because obviously it's important to the company to have those relationships. Mm-hmm. And so, so we have 3 colleagues out there.
And do you have internships?
Yes, we do. We do have internships. And I think we're working on through the Federal Communications Bar Association, a diversity inclusion program that's like bar association wide. So mm-hmm. that's another avenue.
And so now the new Fox, what does the future look like for new Fox, and how does that impact your work? And obviously maybe the example you just gave is an example of how it's impacting your work.
Yeah.
But what's the new Fox look like?
So the new Fox is, a lot of people think of us as Fox News. Obviously they're like a mm-hmm. big part of the business, but mm-hmm. we also do live sports and we do mm-hmm. entertainment. So The Masked Singer is a show that many, many of your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with. That's like mm-hmm. our big flagship show. And so the emphasis is on live and doing high quality live programming. Mm-hmm. And so that's the new Fox, but then also recognizing the shift to digital, the shift to streaming, and sort of keeping up with that, because that's where the competition is.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, Gail, this has been fantastic. It was worth the wait.
Likewise.
A shout out and a thank you to Dusty for suggesting you as a guest. We really enjoyed this. And for our listeners out there, remember you can follow us on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We also have an email that comes out on Monday with the show. You can sign up for that at thepoliticallife.com. And it comes out every Monday with little tidbits about our guests and the show and everything going on. So we hope you all have a great week, and we will see you next Monday.